problem for Christianity is that it's been too successful. Basically, everyone has accepted its essential principles. So what is there left for the churches to do?
Suddenly, I think people are being forced to ask, well, why do I believe in this idea of freedom and human rights and equality and dignity and progress?
What there is left for the churches to do is to talk about the stuff that no one else is talking, which is all the supernatural stuff.
Can my secular humanist outlook actually sustain that? And that's why I think Tom's voice has been so significant in this conversation, because he's basically just reminded people, well, no, it can't.
I had a bowel cancer diagnosis right in the midst of the Omicron spike. But I went to this place where the Virgin had appeared and I gave a heartfelt prayer, you know, come on, please. And as a Protestant agnostic, the idea that I had had a Marian intervention seemed to me so sublimely funny.
Hello there, I'm Justin Briley. Welcome to episode 17, a special edition of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. I know a lot of people have been waiting very patiently for this one, my public conversation with historian Tom Holland, which took place earlier in March. Also look out towards the end of today's episode for some exciting news about a prize that this podcast recently received, plus a sneak peek at what's coming up next as we return to our documentary format next time. Before we jump in, just a reminder that you can get super early access to shows like this when you become a silver supporter at justinbriley.com. Gold level supporters also receive signed copies of both my books and a chance for a monthly catch up, and you can support via Patreon or US tax deductible giving. If you've been enjoying this podcast, why not consider helping us to continue it through the rest of the year? The links are with today's show. Well, what an amazing evening this was. Thanks to LICC for hosting the event at London's Westminster Chapel. And thanks to everyone who came. We had an audience of about 600 people, as well as audience Q&A. We talk about Tom's thesis that the West is still fundamentally Christian in terms of its values and ethics. Tom shares some candid details of his own spiritual journey. And we go back and forth on my thesis that we may be due for a rebirth of belief in God with the waning of new atheism and the rise of a new conversation on the value of faith among secular intellectuals. And Tom, I think, is one of those people. So here to introduce the conversation are our hosts for the evening, Paul Woolley and Grace Fielding. Just before we jump into the rest of today's show, one of the voices you'll hear on this podcast is friend of the show, Glenn Scrivener, a brilliant Christian communicator. Glenn has recently put together an online course called 321. It's an introduction to Christianity that's imaginative, stimulating, and assumes no prior knowledge. If you've been thinking about exploring faith for yourself, or if you want something to share with your friends, 321 is just the thing. Glenn presents 8 video-led sessions which are beautifully shot and animated. I found it a really engaging and practical way of connecting the big ideas in this podcast to our everyday life. I'm already thinking of people I can share it with. See for yourself at 321course.com/JB. It's completely free. Just start a free account with your email and a password and you're in. There's no spam, no hidden costs. Go to 321course.com/JB and discover life according to Jesus.
Could we be witnessing a return of belief in our generation? It's often argued that the Christian story that shaped the West has been replaced by sweeping secularism. But is that the end of the story? What is the state of play in regard to religious belief in the West today? And what are the implications for our everyday lives?
To consider these questions, we are joined by Justin Briley and Tom Holland. Justin is a writer, a broadcaster, and author of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, published just last year. He is convinced that we are witnessing a growing wave of faith. Tom is an historian, author, and presenter, along with Dominic Sambrook, of the brilliant The Rest is History podcast. His book, Dominion, argues that the emergence of Christianity is the single most transformative development in Western history. Furthermore, Christianity's enduring impact on the West can be seen in the emergence of much that has traditionally been seen as opposed to Christianity, specifically in science, in secularism, and even in atheism.
So Justin and Tom, thank you so much for joining us. It's really brilliant to have you here this evening. So let's get right into it. And perhaps I can start with you, Justin, before we turn to you, Tom, and then get a bit of a conversation going. Firstly, Justin, congratulations on your book. It's informative, inspiring, challenging, surprising all at once. And I think the commendations are a real testament to that. I think we can probably all guess, but without reading out your book, what's your thesis? And maybe you could start with Matthew Arnold, The Sea of Faith, and a bit about the rise of new atheism.
Well, in a way, I tried to summarise the thesis of the book in its subtitle, which is Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. But yes, in the introduction, I reference a well-worn line from the Victorian poet Matthew Arnold, from his poem Dover Beach, where he talks about, in his age, the melancholy, long-withdrawing roar of the Sea of Faith, which stood for the way in which secularism, science arguably, was sort of taking the place of religious belief in his generation. And 150 years on, you could say that's only accelerated in the West. But I suppose the catalyst for me writing about a rebirth of belief in God actually began sort of with a conversation I was hosting when I was hosting The Unbelievable Show with Douglas Murray, who's a sort of quite a well-known thinker, opposite New Testament historian Tom Wright. And it was actually Douglas Murray who said, referencing this line from Matthew Arnold, well, the thing about the Sea of Faith is that it could come back in again. That's the point of tides. And that struck me afresh at that point, because this was in the context of Murray talking about the idea that actually he was seeing, interestingly, just a few of his secular peers starting to take Christianity seriously, and some of them converting even. And I'd been noticing a similar trend. I had been hosting these conversations between Christians and atheists for, you know, over 15 years at this point. And I had noticed a kind of change in the atmosphere and the way the conversations were happening, from the very boisterous, dogmatic voices of the new atheists, so Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and so on, which was really when the show began, in that sort of heightened atmosphere of skepticism and kind of dismissal, really, of religion. And hosted a lot of conversations between those sorts of folk and Christian thinkers. But then, in more recent years, I'd noticed a change, more and more of the atheists coming on the show saying, well, I'm not a Richard Dawkins kind of atheist. And sort of distancing themselves from this new atheist movement. And indeed, often some of the guests who were not Christians, but were very sympathetic to the value of Christianity and having very different kinds of conversations because of it. And I just started to wonder with, again, some of these surprising stories of conversion, the fact that the conversations were changing, there seemed to be a change in the atmosphere, and particularly noticing that the new atheist sort of movement had sort of, yes, risen very fast, but also quite dramatically collapsed in various ways. I just wondered if something was going on that needed spelling out a bit. And so that's really where the book came from and sort of what I've tried to make the case for.
Justin, do you think you're being surprisingly optimistic? I am thinking of that that phrase that the plural of anecdote is data. And I just want to question whether that, in fact, is the case. It's one thing to have some really interesting, lively conversations with public figures who appear to be rediscovering faith, but it's another to suggest there is a broader, deeper trend. I recently came across some data from the Diocese of Hereford, which is not, of course, the beginning or the end of Christianity in the UK or the West, but nonetheless, it was striking in that it showed that there are more churches in the Diocese of Hereford than there are children.
Wow.
That suggests there's a problem.
Than children in the churches.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. that would be remarkable. So tell me, do you think, am I being unfair to you? But I mean,
yeah, you know, I mean, and the moment I published the book cover on social media, I was deluged with skeptics saying, what surprising rebirth, because all of the data is in the opposite direction. We're all quite familiar probably with the statistics that tell us we've increasing church decline in the West, religiosity, you know, people saying I'm a nun, as in don't have any religious affiliation. And I spell all that out quite clearly actually in the book, that is the picture we have. I suppose I'm optimistic because I'm inherently a bit optimistic. I think in a sense, as a Christian, I feel like optimism is kind of baked in, even if it's all looking a bit sad and, you know, dismal outside. There is a kind of inherent hope that there is this idea that bad situations get turned around. But beyond just my kind of personal faith in that sense, I think what I was witnessing did feel like a genuine thing. Not, I didn't have data to say X number of secular intellectuals are now talking positively about Christianity, and I certainly didn't have any data saying there's this influx into the pews. But I did just sense that the conversations that were naturally opening up did seem to reflect a difference in the atmosphere. So if it's anything in terms of this sea of faith potentially coming back in, all I'm really, I think, pointing out is that it feels like the tide might be just beginning to turn. Not that there is some big wave coming back at us, but it feels like we're just at that moment where the tide is turning. Having said all that, I do think, interestingly, there are just some telltale signs, possibly, even, you know, statistically, that something might be going on. I was only very recently, and if you listen to the podcast episode that dropped just today, there's a fascinating bit of research that's been done in Finland, for instance, which shows that among sort of, I think it's something like 18 to 24-year-old men, between 2011 and 2019, there is now over double the number of those young men in churches in Finland, which is weird. And sort of doesn't appear to have yet been repeated in other Nordic countries. But I just wondered whether that might be a sign that something's happening, especially in a younger demographic. And again, I've heard, again, this isn't sort of in any way sort of saying this is definitely happening. But again, hearing other pieces of data which suggest that there's a kind of an openness, a new openness, especially among a younger generation, to faith, to the transcendent. And I almost wonder if some of those folk almost missed the new atheist moment and they're sort of actually haven't been as skeptically kind of wired in that sense towards something spiritual. So I just wonder if there's some stirrings of something on the horizon.
Mm. Justin, you've mentioned various conversations that you've had with people over the years, whether on your podcast or public thinkers like Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray, obviously you've mentioned. I just wondered, are there any particularly kind of standout conversations or moments that have really surprised you? And then if I can tag a question onto that as well. Obviously, you mentioned the data in Finland that's just come out, and it struck me that lots of the people that you've mentioned, and that data in particular, is around sort of males.
Yes.
Do you feel like this is a particularly male phenomenon?
Well, I'll come to the kind of memorable conversation in a moment, but I think it's a really interesting question because, you know, for good or bad, it does feel like a lot of the energy is coming from a lot of male podcasters, for instance, a lot of people with platforms. So, you know, the Jordan Peterson type phenomenon, I think, is quite significant here. And I think it's sort of indisputable that it is a primarily male audience that's turning up for that. I mean, YouTube itself is a very male demographic in general. I've kind of got some vague thoughts about why this might be. And I think it's something around, I think there's a kind of an identity crisis going on in the culture. And I think it's kind of impacting men in particular. And I don't have any sort of big theory for that, but I do feel like that we've sort of seen a generation of men who are very confused about how to be a man in the 21st century. And the sort of, if you like, the examples of the past often don't feel right, and yet they don't feel comfortable necessarily in some of what's being offered now. And I think I think that's why specifically the Jordan Peterson types have been so attractive, because Peterson, I think, has essentially been a kind of a father figure to a lot of these men. And I just continually meet a lot of sort of young to middle-aged sort of men who are going on some kind of a sort of having a sort of spiritual midlife crisis or something, where they're sort of saying, I just don't feel comfortable now with where I was in the answers that, as I say, the new atheism offered. And I just feel like there's something else. I need to kind of explore this. But I think it's as much about an identity thing as it is about a kind of spiritual thing. The conversation, and I'm going to reference Tom here, because one of my favorite conversations, which I talk about in the book, and you can hear a smidgen of in a recent episode, was when Tom sat down with well-known atheist philosopher A.C. Grayling for a conversation, and I'm sure you remember it too, Tom. But if you haven't listened to that episode, it's well worth listening to, because it was a very guilty pleasure to hear Tom kind of schooling A.C. Grayling in his history of the of late antiquity. But the it was just really interesting because, you know, in a sense, the show was normally always a sort of a Christian versus atheist or some kind of dynamic. And Tom wasn't particularly coming in to be the quote-unquote Christian guest, but he was defending essentially this idea that Christianity is essentially given us our moral instincts.
Yeah.
And opposite a very skeptical A.C. Grayling. And it was just the most invigorating, exhilarating conversation that I've ever been in the middle of. So it was just hugely fun.
Sounds well worth a listen.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I remember that. And I also remember back in 2005, I was setting up a think tank called Theos. And I was reading a lot of the new atheists. And most of the people that I was reading were men. And I wonder whether there's an interesting correlation there in that the people I was reading were people like Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens. It's interesting that some of the people that you're referencing in this book are also men.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Tom, we need to come to you. What do you make of Justin's thesis? I mean, do you think he is being ridiculously optimistic? What's your take on that?
Well, I think on the global scale, Christianity is clearly still spreading, I mean, like Pentecostal wildfire. It is, I mean, Pentecostalism, for instance, is spreading in Catholic South America. Christianity wholesale is having this incredible spread in Africa. And I think it's the most dramatic expansion of Christian belief since the early Middle Ages in Europe. And it's happening in Asia as well. It's, you know, it's happened in Korea, it's happening in China, though to what extent it's difficult to get a handle on. So I think on the global scale, Christianity is doing fine. It's in the West, of course, that it seems to be in precipitous decline. And I mean, Justin's book is about the rebirth of belief in God. I think there is a slight degree of optimism in thinking that there is a revival in that. But I do think that this idea of, let's call it Christian civilization, the Christian vibe, whatever you want to call it, I think that that in the West remains as vital as it has ever done. And I think that one of the reasons why I am slightly skeptical about the idea that belief in God is making a revival is because I think that the distinctive form that Christianity has taken, say, in this country, but particularly in the United States, because the United States, if you're an Anglophone country, is so culturally preponderant. I think the course that mainstream culture is taking in the United States is obviously massively, massively influenced by a distinctive road that Protestantism in particular is taking. And you said that that the blurb for Dominion, I say that atheism is a logical endpoint. I think that the instinct to topple superstition and banish it and get rid of anything that, the sola scriptura argument of Luther and the early reformers, this idea that you should get rid of anything that you can't get from the Bible. Essentially, Protestantism has reached a point, for the majority, where scripture itself has been got rid of. Everything has been got rid of. But that instinct, that belief that you can know the truth in the depth of your soul, that remains. And it is going off in all kinds of mad directions at the moment. I think that the 60s is as will be seen in the long kind of view of history as being as influential on the history of the West as the 1520s were. And that just as the 1520s did, it's breeding all kinds of factions, all kinds of squabbling sectarian debates that nevertheless are swept up on a great kind of ideological wave of excitement. And what this process will be called, I don't know. I mean, it took Protestants a long time to work out that they'd been living through something called the Reformation, for instance, and it took Catholics even longer to accept that it should be called the Reformation. So who knows what, but I think we are living through something weird like that, and I think that it is palpably driven by Christian impulses, but I don't think that it any more requires a belief in God. So that would be my take.
Do you think in the future we might look back and say, oh, the kindling was there that rekindled the Christian faith? It was going on, we didn't necessarily see it.
Well, so I think that the new atheists are palpably an endpoint in a Christian tradition. Richard Dawkins is, I mean, he is spreading good news. You know, he is an evangelist. And his good news is that if you get rid of superstition, then you will be a happier and better person. You know, you will be able to hear your conscience in a clear way that you wouldn't have been able to with the kind of the static that religion had provided. And that basically is the Reformation argument. I mean, that is Luther saying, get rid of all this nonsense and you will be able to hear the voice of the Spirit in your heart. So Richard Dawkins seems to me a logical endpoint for that. I think that I completely agree with Justin that that kind of confident evangelical atheism has crumbled and collapsed. I think it has so many kind of contradictions within it that it hasn't really been able to put down firm roots. But I think that what certainly in Britain, I mean, maybe less so in the United States, but certainly in Britain, what we have now is a situation where most people simply do not know enough about Christianity or the Bible even to be against it. Richard Dawkins and new atheists are always dropping verses from the Bible to prove that God is, you know, a genocidal tyrant or whatever, or that it's all nonsense or it doesn't accord with evolution or whatever you want to do. But people now, by and large, generations growing up, I think the mass of them have no, I mean, they don't know the Bible at all. They never read it. They have no familiarity, even with the most basic stories, the Good Samaritan or the Passion or Exodus or any of these things, David and Goliath, stuff that has been part of the mental furniture of people in this country, certainly for, you know, for 1,000 years and more. And that is a massive, massive change. Now, for Christians, I guess, you know, that's depressing to think that something that has been part of the common currency of people in this country is fading. But I guess if you wanted to be optimistic, and you know, from Justin's point of view, looking for signs that God, the belief in God, might come back, maybe this is what it needs. I mean, maybe you need to spring clean before you can kind of, you know, redecorate your room. So the fact that maybe you need a kind of, you know, a clear palate, maybe all the kind of the institutional cultural Christianity is getting in the way of seeing the radicalism and the revolutionary quality of Christianity. I don't know, but maybe that's possible.
I mean, I guess there are fewer people inoculated against Christianity at school, just because it's not present in school in the way that it was. And therefore, in a sense, there is that fresh palette, that blank sheet of paper. I suppose the other interesting thing is to observe the denominations, the streams, the networks that are growing.
Yeah.
And they are, perhaps not surprisingly, Elam, for example, so evangelical, often charismatic, theologically orthodox, they tend to be the churches that are growing in the UK.
Well, so I mean, my feeling, and again, I don't have the statistics to hand on this because I freely admit that I'm not incredibly knowledgeable about the current state of Christianity in the UK. But my sense, and this is anecdotal sense, is that the churches that are doing well in this country are certainly in London. The statistics for Christian belief in London are really very good by the standards of the rest of the country. I'm sure, you know, there's no Hereford situation in the boroughs of London. And that's clearly driven by immigration. So there are lots of people coming from very devoutly Christian countries that are bringing their beliefs with them. So I live in Brixton. I have a church at the top of my road that is always heaving. And that's very much a kind of immigrant focused. I've so glad to have the opportunity to announce this, that I've just begun going to a gym and have stuck. And you go out to the gym, I have this brilliant Bulgarian personal trainer who drives me very, very hard, and he's always taking me out into this kind of outside annex where there's this kind of torture chamber and puts me through all these tortures. And I find myself, you know, I'm agonizing, looking up at sweat pouring everywhere and looking up over this barbed wire fence, and it really does feel like a kind of prison compound. And there's a ruach on the other side, so a kind of Pentecostal. And this is heaving as well. So I think that that is obviously an area of growth. But I think that across the country as a whole, the area of growth seems to be churches that take the supernatural seriously. So it could be evangelical ones, but it could also be kind of Anglo-Catholic ones. Mm. It's churches that take all the stuff about angels and signs from God and miracles and everything seriously, because I don't understand why anyone would be interested in a Christianity that isn't taking this stuff seriously. And I think the huge problem that a lot of institutional Christianity has in this country, whether it's Church of England, Catholic Church, whatever, is that there is a desire, whether conscious or not, on the part of many of the people responsible for it, to accommodate themselves to what they feel is the ideological mainstream. And again, this is exactly what happened in the 16th century with the Reformation, that as the Reformation started putting down its roots, whether in London or Oxford and Cambridge, or, you know, the centres of ideological power, so people who had been raised Catholic began accommodating themselves to this new Protestant dispensation. And I think that this is what's happening now with the mainstream churches, is that they are accommodating themselves to where the excitement is, which is a kind of Americanized progressivism. And, you know, you just have to hear anyone pretty much on Thought for the Day to realize that this is where the action is. And again, to go back to Luther, and I keep mentioning Luther because I've been researching and recording a series for The Rest is History, which you very kindly mentioned, the podcast I do. Luther staged a famous debate with Johann Eck shortly after he had done his 95 Theses and before he gets the papal bull threatening him with excommunication. And in this debate, it is generally accepted that Luther has the worst of it. That Eck, who is speaking up for Catholic orthodoxy, you know, has won. But in the long run, it doesn't matter. And the reason for that is that what Luther is saying is so exciting. And the weight of social media opinion behind him is so great that Eck just ends up being completely flattened by it. And nobody remembers him or cares about him. Everyone remembers Luther. And I think that for the mainstream churches in this country, that is they are in the situation of Eck at the moment. It doesn't matter what they say, really. They are simply unfashionable, and what they're saying is not exciting. And I think that there is also a sense that they don't 100% have the courage of their convictions, whereas it's the people who are saying, the Spirit speaks to me, I talk in tongues, alleluia, healings, whatever. You know, that's unusual, that's unexpected. People might sit up and say, well, that really is unexpected. Or churches where you have a palpable sense of the sublime, visions of the Virgin, all that kind of stuff. Again, that's weird and odd and unexpected, and not the kind of thing that you would get on Radio 4. So I think that churches have to major on what they have to offer that everyone else doesn't. I think the problem for Christianity is that it's been too successful. Basically, everyone has accepted its essential principles. You know, you get them all. Everyone should be, you know, kind to the poor and all this kind of thing. Everyone buys into that. The things that the church traditionally did, education, hospital, poor relief, this has all been nationalised. So what is there left for the churches to do? What there is left for the churches to do is to talk about the stuff that no one else is talking, which is all the supernatural stuff.
Tom, that's so interesting. And you've talked there about the influence that Christianity has had on our culture, on Western culture. You talk about the way humanism is entirely based as a construct on the Christian tradition in the West. I want to ask you a personal question, and you, of course, are at total liberty to just sidestep it if you want. But the question that I have is, to what extent are you an observer or participant in all of this? So you appear in Justin's book.
Yeah.
We've heard about the episode that you were on with A.C. Grayling. But to what extent are you part of the phenomenon that Justin describes, or are you also observing what is going on?
Well, I've talked about this quite a lot. So for people who've heard me talk about it before, I apologize, but I can only answer the question I'm being asked. So I was raised Christian. I never had a kind of moment where I thought, oh, Christianity's terrible, I hate you, God, damn you, Father, all that kind of thing. I just didn't believe it. It just kind of faded. And I found the pagan gods more exciting and interesting. You know, Aphrodite or Dionysus just seemed more interesting and kind of charismatic than the Christian God. But my opinion on this started changing as I began to appreciate how deeply culturally Christian I was and how the things that I believe in my gut are not just givens, and that it's not human nature to believe the kind of stuff that I believe because I am a product of a Christian world. And so that's how I came to write Dominion, where I was essentially stress testing this idea that all the things that I, as a secular, liberal, agnostic, believed were essentially a gift from Christianity. And I say gift, but I mean for bad as well as good. So that was why I ended up writing Dominion and becoming completely fascinated by the cultural and historical influence that Christianity had had. Over the course of researching Dominion, I started going back to various churches because I wanted to experience as close as I could something of the vividness of what I was writing about. Because I think one of the problems with writing history is that it is, by and large, a materialist discipline. There is no place for it, for manifestations of the supernatural. But I think that that's a real problem if you're writing about people for whom the supernatural is a fundamental part of their worldview, because you can't really kind of get in their shoes and feel and understand what they feel and understand. And so I was trying to make this kind of leap of understanding to try and see the world through the eyes of believing Christians, whether they were medieval or 16th century or whatever. And I found that very moving, because I found that I wanted the kind of the excitement, really, that a belief in the supernatural would give. And because Christianity is the mainstream tradition, I mean, I can't go and worship Athena or something. I mean, that would just be mad. But Christianity, you know, it's possible for me to immerse myself in the waters of Christian belief and kind of feel that I'm sharing in it. And this was... I think that it would be merely cosplaying were it not for the fact that I had a couple of experiences that I can, if I squint in a certain way, see as being a supernatural, a contact with the supernatural. So the first of these was I made a film about why the Islamic State were persecuting the Yazidis and the Christians, the way that they were persecuting them. And as part of that, I went to a town called Sinjar in northern Iraq that had been occupied by the Islamic State. And they had, notoriously, they had executed the Yazidi men who they saw as being devil worshippers and crucified some of them in this town. And they had enslaved the younger women and shot the older ones. And we went to film in this town a couple of weeks after it had been liberated by the Kurdish militia from the Islamic State. But the Islamic State was still very much kind of across no man's land, about 2 miles away, across open desert. So I'm not a brave person. And if I'd known that this was on the agenda when I went to make this film, I wouldn't have gone. Mm. But because we got there and we unexpectedly had this opportunity to go to the town, and the director and the cameraman, everyone was going, brilliant, this is so exciting, isn't it? Fabulous. And I was kind of wanly going, oh, great. So we ended up in this place, and the kind of it was incredibly hot. There was a kind of stench of death hanging over it. There was ruins everywhere. There were, you know, tripwires and bombs, and you know, it was awful. And the admiration I feel for war correspondents who keep going back to these kind of places over and over is off the scale, because I will never go back to somewhere like that. But there was a church, and we went to this church. It had been built by Armenian refugees from the genocide in the Ottoman Empire. And then they'd come here, and then fresh genocidal enemies had turned up. So they've had a very bad run. And in this church, the Islamic State fighters had demolished the altar with power drills, and they had toppled over the font, and they had pulled down all the icons and smashed them and jumped up and down on them. And I saw, amid all the kind of the rubble and the broken glass, there was this kind of piece of paper, card that had been left. And I picked it up, and it was a picture of the Annunciation. So the great wings of Gabriel sweeping backwards as he knelt before the Virgin. And I felt that I felt it was a kind of one of those thin places that people talk about, where the dimension of the heavenly suddenly seems incredibly close. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk in this vein in a congregationalist church, but it's going to get worse. I can tell you. But it felt incredibly vivid, and I kept that image. And I was in a place where people had been crucified, and a sense of what that meant. To be, you know, 2 miles away, to have people who had thought, as the Romans had thought, that execution and crucifixion were ways of upholding their power. That's the power, that's the signification the cross had for these people, not as a symbol of the power of the weak over the strong, but the opposite, power of the strong over the weak. And it was, you know, it was a kind of existentialist abyss opened up before me. And so I think I was, for that reason, very open to the sense of angels' wings brushing overhead in this desecrated church. I mean, I was dehydrated. I was in a mess. I mean, I can come up with all kinds of Dawkins-esque reasons why I felt like this. But it was a very vivid, real feeling to me, and I kind of cherish it. And then, you know, and I kind of put this image away and kind of, you know, it was a kind of souvenir of my trip, but not really much more. And I did think, well, it was all just dehydration and exhaustion. And then I, as part of my church tourism, I went to St. Bartholomew the Great, which is a part of a priory that was built 901 years ago this year. The hospital was also a part of it, which still exists. So it's very old, medieval, so I went there. And this is supposedly the only place that the Virgin appeared in London, recorded appearance of the Virgin. And she turned up in the 12th century to tell off the monks who'd got the liturgy wrong. It was kind of very bossy appearance. But I like that. And it was also the place where in the Lady Chapel, when the Lady Chapel got built in the wake of this manifestation and then got sold off, with the Reformation, and it became a radical printer's office, and Benjamin Franklin worked there. So this church is the only place where both the Virgin and Benjamin Franklin had appeared. And it seemed to me the embodiment of everything that I was writing about in Dominion. So I found the services there very, very powerful and moving, and they're very, kind of very high church, so they're kind of the opposite of this, I guess. But I found them very, very moving, very sublime. And so I went to that. And then in the COVID outbreak, the last one, the Omicron spike, which I think was just before Christmas, was it 21? I can't remember. Yes, I think it was Christmas 21. I had a bowel cancer diagnosis right in the midst of the Omicron spike. So the hospital was absolutely being overwhelmed. And I went in and I had the endoscopy, and the surgeon said, well, it doesn't look good. I mean, you know, it might have spread. It might have gone into your lymph nodes. So we're going to send you off for scans. But I think basically, looking at it, I think that we're going to have to cut out a huge chunk of your bowel, give you a colostomy bag, and then stitch it back together again in 6 weeks. And that should get rid of the cancer, unless it's spread to the lymph nodes. But we'll find out about that. We'll let you know before Christmas Eve. And Christmas Eve came, and there was no, you know, they didn't tell me. And I in no way blame them, because I knew that they were overwhelmed. I mean, it was the worst kind of time to be having this kind of treatment. And so, but I felt kind of, oh, Lordy. So I went to Midnight Mass at Bart's that Christmas Eve. And at the end of the service, I looked over to where the Virgin had appeared. And I thought, well, might as well give it a go. You know, there's no atheist in a foxhole. What have I got to lose? So I went, and I haven't prayed. I mean, when I was young, and I thought, I've got to pray for everyone or they'll die. And I remember that kind of nervousness as a seven-year-old, thinking, who have I left off? I don't want them to die. And I hadn't really prayed since then. But I went to this place where the Virgin had appeared, and I gave a heartfelt prayer. You know, come on, please. And all kinds of things went right from that point on. And I won't go into the details, but basically, it seemed miraculous that in the most unexpected way, I not only got access to the photos, which told me that I didn't have cancer in the lymph nodes, but also I found out that I didn't have cancer. The cancer hadn't spread from the polyp, and that therefore I didn't need to have this chunk of the gut removed. And 2 years on, I seem clear of it. So I dodged a massive, massive bullet there. And again, the perfectly rational reasons how this happened, but it was so unexpected, and I don't want to go into the details of it, but they required so many coincidences that I have been tempted to see it as miraculous. And I told this story to a well-known Australian singer who I think may even be in this audience here, I'm not sure, and said, you know, obviously it is a coincidence, but I feel ungrateful to the Virgin for saying that. And he said, well, yeah, I think you are being ungrateful. And I felt schooled and started to think, well, you know, have I had a Marian visitation? And then I started thinking about that that piece of, you know, that image of the Annunciation, and thinking, was I wrong when I focused on the angel? Was I actually focusing on, should I have actually focused on the Virgin? Was she there? And as a Protestant agnostic, the idea that I had had a Marian intervention seemed to me so sublimely funny. And I thought, well, I mean, if it's true, God has the most wonderful sense of humor. And I kind of like the idea of a God with that kind of sense of humor. And I hug to myself the thought that I've been touched by something that utterly transcends every prejudice that I would have against the possibility of it happening. You know, not just that it is supernatural, but that it is, I mean, essentially kind of medieval, Catholic, I mean, everything that I would view myself as not being. And God, so funny. I mean, you know, what a trick to pull. And so I'm in a kind of liminal space where there are times where I think, amazing. I have, you know, I look at this image and think, wow. And then there are other times where I just think, wow, you know, it's all just coincidence and madness. And I think about deep space and dinosaurs and it all goes. But it's kind of, you know, those kind of visual things where it's what is it? It's either a rabbit or a duck, depending on, it's impossible for it to be both at the same time. And I kind of feel like that sometimes it looks like a duck and sometimes it looks like a hare. And I'm kind of midway. So
interesting. I have two reflections, or one reflection and one question. The reflection is, if Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was preacher here for 30 years, is listening into this conversation, I think he will be raising an eyebrow or two.
Well, do you know, but this is what is so interesting, is that I have told this to a number of people, let's call them professional Christians. And I can't say that any of them have really shown any belief, any conviction that it's possible. I mean, they almost all, I think they've all kind of responded with a really kind of polite scepticism, which kind of makes it all the more exciting.
Well, that's interesting.
That I believe something that even Christians don't believe in.
That's interesting, because my second question, or the question was, you know, what's it going to take? As you were speaking then, Tom, I was thinking of C.S. Lewis, who described himself as being the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. And I just wondered whether that is actually a description of you, that what does it
I'm
take?
I'm not dejected.
What does it take?
I'm not dejected. I mean,
reluctant?
I mean, part of me worries that it's a kind of, that I'm being conceited, that it's a kind of arrogance to think that I would have been given this weird experience. I mean, it's a form of arrogance to think that, I think. I think it's much more modest to assume that it's just a conjunction of circumstances and all kinds of things like that. I mean, to imagine that the Mother of God has intervened is, I mean, it's very arrogant. And you mentioned C.S. Lewis. And actually, again, I'm being unbelievably conceited here. It's actually Tolkien that I think of. And I think of Frodo and Sam going into Mordor and being absolutely kind of in the Valley of the Shadow of Death. And they have this vision of Galadriel speaking to them. And Galadriel in that moment is clearly inspired by Tolkien's profound Catholicism and clearly has shades of the Virgin. And the idea that the history might be vivid with the potential of the supernatural, as it was for someone like Tolkien, I mean, it's very exciting to me, very exciting. But as I say, I mean, to compare yourself to Frodo is... I mean, it's immodest, I think.
Well, I mean, if I may interject, because you very kindly shared that story you just shared about cancer scare.
You also
and I was a bit like, well, that was left field, you know. But actually, I do think there's something in what you're saying, Tom, about this idea that God works in strange, surprising, some almost hilarious ways. And for me, you know, I think your name is quite appropriate, because I think you are something of the doubting Thomas, obviously. But then we're all a mixture, I think, if we call ourselves Christian or not, of faith and doubt. And I have those moments where I think, you know, is it all really true, you know? But I think that's just human nature. So I don't think that your story is necessarily sort of completely at odds with the Christian experience generally. But the other thing I think about, what I love about you, Thomas, is as a Thomas who went to India, purportedly, to evangelize. And I just feel like, in a strange way, you, as someone who is very honest about your doubt, as well as your moments of possible inspiration, you've actually reaching an audience that the average Christian would actually find it really difficult to, because I think people feel like you're
well,
not just there to sell.
But I've torched that now
it.
That I've talked about.
Well, I don't know. I think what you've said is something for me that is just saying this is what happened, you know, and it's a bit strange, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it myself. But I think that actually hits quite close, because I think in my experience, even the most hardened skeptic atheist has moments like that where they actually struggle sometimes to make sense of an experience, and they could just do the Dawkins, you know, rationalization of it. But I think lots of people have a memory, a bit like the moment in Sinjar or whatever, where something felt different. And I just wonder whether there's more of an openness at this point to saying, well, maybe I can lean in the direction that something really strange happened, rather than it was just the cheese I had last night or the dehydration. I just feel like there's more of an openness to people kind of giving that possibility a go, that it's not just all explained by chemicals, neurons, and blind forces of nature in that way.
Before we come to the questions, which I think are coming in thick and fast, I just wanted to ask, so Justin, if, and then I'll come to you, Tom, here's a heads up. Justin, if you are right then about this resurgence of belief in God, what does this mean in terms of what are the implications then for us in our everyday lives or in our work, for example?
I think there's probably two different audiences that I'd want to sort of pitch this at. I think probably most of the people present here probably perhaps think of themselves as Christian, though not necessarily. And I think for Christians who sort of are sort of living in this Christian story, I think it's really important to recognize that some of the questions have changed, essentially. I think that a lot of effort was spent, and I was part of it in a way, in the mid-2000s, sort of responding to this sort of very deep-rooted skepticism of Dawkins and co. And so we, you know, Christian apologetics was all about creating five arguments for the existence of God and four arguments for the resurrection and so on. I just wonder whether it's time to change tack in that sense, because I don't think that's actually where most people are starting now. I think there is a kind of a more of an openness to the role of the imagination, to the transcendent, to experiences. I mean, I see this all over the culture where you're seeing people kind of getting much more interested now in LSD and sort of, you know, hallucinogenic drugs and things like that. Even Sam Harris, you know, the arch new atheist, is constantly banging on about spiritual experience and transcendence, even if he has an ultimately a kind of material explanation for that. It's like suddenly everyone needs to sort of make sense of their lives at a level that goes beyond science and reason. And so I think it's important that, in the way Tom was saying, that the impulse of Protestantism has been to kind of basically play the same game as the Enlightenment, sort of, let's just rationalize all this.
The other way around. The Enlightenment game as Protestantism.
Yeah.
I mean,
Exactly. But either way, it's like you say New Atheism was sort of the end point of that process. It was sort of, we've rationalized everything so that we can even rationalize away faith itself in that sense. And I think we need, the challenge for the Christian church, especially with what Tom said, is we maybe want to return to something that is actually a bit more about our imagination and helping people to think about a world they would like to exist, a world where you don't immediately try and nail it down in purely logical terms. I co-host a podcast called Reenchanting, which Tom has kindly been on, and again, that's drawing on that idea of, in a disenchanted world, can we re-enchant it with something about the strangeness, weirdness, surprisingness that people, I feel, are just a bit more open to now. And I think that is about, you know, keeping Christianity weird, as Tom says. It's about sort of not trying to just ape the culture in terms of a sort of secular humanism, but with a bit of God sprinkled on top. I think lean into the weirdness of our faith, because that's actually, you know, if you go back to the early church, that is why the church grew. It was incredibly weird in the first century. As Tom says, the problem is all the things that made them so weird are now no longer weird. Of course we believe in human rights and equality and the dignity of women and children. But so how do we re-enchant people with the weirdness of that? And if I may, like, one more thing that I think is a part of that is that I think one of the reasons why Tom's work has been so influential here is because we're just entering a moment in culture where the Christian assumptions are no longer necessarily absolutely central. Because there are other worldviews that are suddenly entering the fray. There is potentially fundamentalist Islam. There are potentially other ideologies. There are the Putins and the Chinas of this world who have a very different view of what it means to be human. And I think as we increasingly see the possibility, and I think the kind of Ukraine war was a sort of one of those moments of another way of thinking about life coming in, suddenly I think people are being forced to ask, well, why do I believe in this idea of freedom and human rights and equality and dignity and progress? Can my secular humanist outlook actually sustain that? And that's why I think Tom's voice has been so significant in this conversation, because he's basically just reminded people, well, no, it can't, because it didn't come from secular humanism. Humanism literally came from the Christian story. So I just think it's an exciting time to potentially be reimagining how we do that, how we meet the culture in a more imaginative way, and even with lots of the, you know, threats, quote unquote, to the Christian worldview, at the same time, it also makes the Christian worldview more distinctive. And that might be actually a good thing in the long run.
Interesting. Tom, I wonder if I could ask a similar question to you. Obviously, we know you're a historian, but I wondered, yeah, for one night only, whether we could invite you to look into the future and just, yeah, if Justin's thesis is correct and that there is this resurgence in belief in God, as Justin says, which, you know, will become part of a worldview that includes a whole range of philosophical beliefs, how do you see the future of faith shaping out?
Well, I think there are maybe three alternatives, all of which may be going on concurrently. And the first of those is that what was liberalism and has evolved to become progressivism, so is clearly where the excitement and ideological fervour is. So, you know, people argue whether a trans woman is a woman in the same tone of kind of passionate commitment and excitement that people were arguing about transubstantiation in the 16th century. And that, in a way, it's the more it kind of sweeps off, you know, it's freed itself from the moorings of doctrinal and scriptural Christianity, and it still has the Christian vibe at its heart, but it's going off in all kinds of odd ways. I mean, you know, you need maybe someone who has died at the hands of the apparatus of a superpower, but perhaps, you know, it's likelier to be someone killed by an American policeman than it is Jesus today. But it's recognisable where the instinct to bend the knee to this figure and to topple statues in his name. It's clear where this is coming from. I mean, it's, you know, these are very, very culturally determined ways of behaviour, but they are becoming less obviously Christian as the years go by, and so who knows where that will go. I mean, just as people in the 1520s could have no idea that you would end up with, you know, all the Anabaptists and Baptists and Quakers and so on that would emerge over the course of the decades and centuries that followed Luther. So now, I think it's unclear where that kind of progressivism will go, but it's clearly, I think, the dominant ideology now, and every other ideology is either bending the knee to it or reacting violently to it. So the war on woke is defined by woke. The other possibility is that as the institutional and ideological hold of Christianity on the West fades, so people will start to resurrect ideas and principles that Christianity has long served to suppress. So namely, the idea that actually, why should the strong care a thing about the weak? I mean, why shouldn't they trample them down? That's the law of nature. Why shouldn't men sexually dominate women in the way that they did back in the Roman times or whatever? All of these kind of ideas that have been suppressed by Christianity, these modes of behaviour, maybe they will make a comeback. And I think the great inhibitor for that is it hasn't been Christianity for a long time. The inhibitor on that is our cultural memories of the Nazis. It's anxieties about what the Nazis did. Now, we are anxious about the Nazis above all because we have the instincts of Christians. The Nazis repudiated the fundamentals of Christian ideology. You know, they celebrated the strong, they despised the weak. They absolutely thought that Jew and Greek were different. They celebrated the strength of the powerful and they celebrated racism, and so they serve as the kind of the negative image. They, I think, have replaced the Christian mythology for people. But it's possible, even as the memory of Nazism, the impact of Nazism fades, that people will start going back to these kind of primal instincts. Third option is that, rather as I have done, people, and I think this is what Justin is picking up on, that maybe quite a few people are starting to kind of slightly worry about where all this may be going and thinking, well, why do I believe what I believe? And the truth is, I think, that if you honestly look at it, you are taken back to Christian teachings. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that it will result in a return to Christian belief, but perhaps it will result in a kind of a return to respect for what Christianity has given that may provide a seedbed for the growth of Christian belief. But I don't know. I mean, all of those things may be going on simultaneously.
I feel like everything you've said there are all kind of absolutely options on the table. And for me, the point of it all is that religion hasn't actually gone away. It's just been transposed, mutated.
Yeah.
The religious instinct is still there. And in whether it's a kind of, you know, ideologies which are quasi-religious in nature, where, yeah, they demand, you know, absolute allegiance, and there are heretics, and there are liturgies and signs. It's all there. The problem is that taken out of the Christian context, it doesn't have grace and forgiveness. It's a sort of, it's all the worst.
But you say that as a Christian.
I do,
of course,
yes.
You think that is a loss. But I think that you know, we might be in a world where that doesn't matter, and that the excitement is with a new way of seeing the world that doesn't require that. Which I can see.
Yeah, and my other fear is, in a way, that just as you said, we could go back to a sort of more of a pagan idea, a kind of pre-Christian way of looking at things. I also see that happening in real time. So we talked about the whole idea of young men, and kind of maybe there's an identity crisis going on. And I do see, for every Jordan Peterson who's sort of trying to point people back in the direction of the Bible, you've also got your Andrew Tates, who are basically just buying into that sort of, yes, the guy with the biggest harem wins, basically. And I am shocked by the number of young men who are gravitating towards that message. So there's absolutely no reason to assume that Christianity will naturally win the day at a natural level, because people do kind of go back to, I think, a kind of these fundamental instincts almost. I guess it is my optimistic thesis that as people recognize that these are the various options on the table, they're going to suddenly think, oh my goodness, what have we lost in the Christian story? Start to investigate the Christian story again. I think Tom is one of the people doing that par excellence and helping lots of other people to reconsider it. And I suppose my optimism comes from the fact that the cultural memory of Christianity is still strong enough. It's still bubbling away under the surface. We're still seeing it come back with something like when Queen Elizabeth died, for instance, in the kind of national outpouring of grief and religious observance. And there's still enough cultural capital there for Christianity to sort of remind people where this all started. And it might be that actually there's enough there for people to start to investigate it again. As I say, my examples are anecdotal by nature, but I do feel like something has changed. And people who have, I've been talking in some recent episodes about people who maybe feel a bit like Tom, who have kind of become disillusioned with the secular humanist explanation of life and have started to realize that actually a lot of what their deepest longings and desires essentially go back to the Christian story, but they don't know what to do next because they don't live in a world anymore where that religious language is just part and parcel of life, and they've perhaps only ever set foot in church at Christmas and the odd wedding or funeral. And so it's a bit of a mystery. And I think the real challenge for the church today is to say, how can we help you to rediscover this story and make it yours again? Because I do believe at a fundamental level that all of these other stories, all of these other options on the table are just kind of dim echoes of a much bigger story that people actually are wanting to step into if you could show them it was the story that made sense of their lives. So that's, I guess, where my optimism comes from. It's that, all of these different things are just sort of the perversions and idols of what is actually the, good, beautiful and true story, and that story will ultimately prevail. I guess, again, that's the faith in me speaking, but it is, I just feel strongly that wherever we go, even if things get much worse in Western culture, I feel like that story will somehow reassert itself again in, that way.
Tom, Justin, thank you so much. That's been, I know I found it a really thought-provoking, challenging and interesting conversation. And we want to leave lots of time for questions. So Paul, shall we...
Let's do that. We've had 118 questions submitted.
Wow.
And it would take quite a while, if even a minute, each question. but if I encourage you to be as brief as possible, we'll get through as many as possible. So question for you, Justin, first of all, which public figure has moved the needle for the surprising rebirth the most, would you say?
Yeah, I think I talk about a lot of different public figures, some of them quite secular intellectuals who are still pointing people towards the Christian story. He's already been mentioned, but Jordan Peterson, I think, has had quite an interesting effect. And I think the reason, I mean, he's a controversial character, and some, you know, he's a bit of a Marmite character, in as much as people either kind of love him or hate him, I think. But whatever you think of his sort of more culture warrior moments on Twitter, it is just a fact that I have been meeting increasingly people who have just been influenced by his lectures, his podcasts, and his very psychological take on scripture. And I just find it fascinating that it feels like there's been a sort of a ripple effect as he's come in. And I feel like it was very consciously, he was basically inviting the same audience who turned up for The New Atheist to turn up for him and hear a different take on life, psychology, and particularly religion. And so for me, he was kind of the first, it was him that first made me think something's changed here, because when he started to fill out auditoriums for 3-hour lectures on the book of Genesis, I knew something weird was happening, because that would not have happened 10 or 15 years previously. So I think in his way, I think that's, he's been very influential. But I just find there are lots of people who are not necessarily doing it the way he's doing it, but are saying similar-ish things. So as I say, I don't think Tom thinks of himself as an evangelist, but I hear a lot of people quoting Tom to me, saying, you know, oh, I've really changed my mind about the value of faith because I read Dominion. And and Tom, you know, is a very modest chap, but he does happen to co-host one of the most popular podcasts in the world. And that's not insignificant. You know, these are... Although some people said, oh, isn't this just a lot of, you know, slightly academic kind of elites who are talking? But that may be true at one level, but actually there's an awful lot of people listening to them. And I do just think that, say, so folks like Tom, Jordan Peterson and others are having an effect in that way.
Mm. One of our kind of top voted questions is... For all of your interactions with atheists, to what extent is the growing warmth towards Jesus predominantly a middle class or educated class phenomenon?
Mm-hmm. Be interested in Tom's take on this one
either.
Too.
Yeah.
But I think there is absolutely a danger of that. And if I'm honest, you could probably say that the rebirth that I'm talking about probably looks quite middle class and educated in that sense. So I think what's probably the case, though, is that you start with kind of what you see, and then you start to work out that there are, not in the same way, but there are kind of ripples going out in other places and in other demographics. And I think, to some extent, I think there's, you know, I think especially among a younger generation, there's a kind of spiritual hunger that is there. So even with something like, I don't know, TikTok, and you've got masses of young people, you know, and a very demographic on there, I just see a real kind of interest and openness to the transcendent. So you've got like a phenomenon called witch talk on TikTok, which is basically young women kind of teaching you how to cast a hex or do a spell or a good luck charm or whatever it is. And for me, again, that's obviously, it's not Christianity, but it is indicative that there's this kind of openness. There's a sort of people who are on a search in lots of different areas. It's not just the sort of necessarily the middle class men who are, you know, listening to Jordan Peterson on this podcast. It just feels like there's something else. And I just wonder how much, again, the church is aware of what's going on in those spaces and actually how it could adapt itself, cut its cloth to that audience and help to kind of be where they are and speak into their particular sort of the transcendent thing that they are experimenting with and looking for.
Yeah. Tom, anything you'd like to add?
I have no specialist take on this at all. I mean, all I would say is that I think that that everything in England revolves around class. And I think that, you know, the decline of Christianity in England is a part of that, because the divisions in Protestantism in England reach all the way back to certainly to the Civil War and perhaps before that. And the legacy of the Civil War period and the Restoration is that the Anglican Church has always been middle class, identified with the established classes, and the dissenters have been much more focused in the working classes. And that remains absolutely true. I mean, Church of England always famously used to be called the Tory Party at Prayer, which obviously it isn't anymore, but it's still definitely the middle class at Prayer. I mean, it seems to me that the Church of England hierarchy is kind of comically and neurotically middle class, and not least in its embarrassment about being middle class, desperate not to be middle class. And the other thing that has happened is that basically the collapse of Methodism. I mean, it's the famous comment about the Labour Party is that it owed much more to Methodism than to Marx, and I think that's absolutely true. And so the decline in Methodism over the past decades, I think, has been really, really damaging for Christian practice in this country, because it's knocked away one of the pillars of Christianity in the country. Mm. I mean, but I say that without any particular sense of expertise, but that's never worried me in the past.
Two questions, if I can link them together. The first is it possible that young men are more open to faith and belief in God because they feel marginalised and disadvantaged from mainstream society? But then, Tom, as someone who's not marginalised or disenfranchised from mainstream society, what do you think are the best reasons for and against belief in God? And maybe just one of each, if you could.
Well, I think you should do the first one, because that's very much your
gig. So the question about men, I think there is a sense in which, rightly or wrongly, you know, that there is a certain kind of, as I said earlier, identity crisis that I see among a lot of men and young men. And I do think that there's something attractive about the Christian story, for whatever reason, to that demographic. I think, you know, obviously Jesus was a man, but he kind of was very countercultural in the way he included women within his, you know, sort of the followers of Jesus. And the way he treated women was absolutely countercultural in its day and age. And what's interesting is he's the complete anti-type of, as I said, the Tate, you know, because he didn't have a partner. He was effectively a virgin, you know, for his whole life. He was did not seek glory and success, and ultimately got beaten up and crucified. So it's kind of like, and yet, in that, I think you find, if you're looking for a masculine identity, I would want to point people to that beyond anything that Peterson or Tate or anyone else says. I think that I just think there's a recognition that there's something very significant about Jesus. And to that extent, I I think that if there is an answer to sort of the male identity crisis in our culture, it's going to look something like returning to the person of Jesus. I mean, interestingly, how that plays out in terms of women is an interesting one, because I think that there's a sense in which I've been in the world of apologetics for a long time, and it's a very male-dominated world. And for some reason, that particular way of engaging just seems to appeal to the male brain on average. Obviously, there's lots of exceptions to that. But I just feel like there's something about the church has not, for some reason, in the way it's presented itself or something, has not, for some reason, appealed to the male psyche for some time. It feels like that something happened along the way in the 20th century where there was a kind of disconnect. And I just wonder whether we're starting to see the church sort of realize, actually, we need to take seriously the kind of complementarity in that sense of the sexes, and that we need to speak to both, just in the way that Jesus did. And that it might be almost like something of a pendulum swinging back in some way. So that's my kind of my vague thoughts on it. As I say, I don't consider myself an expert either in this, but that's where I would pitch
and
it.
And Tom?
So why would I personally not believe in God?
No, what do you think the best reason for believing and then the best reason for not believing?
Well, again, to quote Luther, who's very much on my mind at the moment, reason is a whore, he said. And he...
Talk us through that.
Well, what he meant was, he said, a Christian should not be a philosopher, a Christian should be a fool. That you don't justify belief in God through reason. You feel it. It's an experience. It's like a love affair, or it's like a glimpse of something precious and inexplicable. And I think that that's true. I don't think that... I think all this kind of five proofs of the existence of God, I don't think it ultimately... I think it's wasted effort. I think you either... I think the best reason for believing in God is because you have an experience of transcendence that opens your eyes to the possibility of it. Against that, there is reason, which says that this is a chemical reaction, that everything is material, that the human brain is programmed to believe in the supernatural. And this is why, over the course of history, the human brain has generated so many gods. And I guess, speaking personally, the thing that... plunges me back into unbelief is thinking how culturally contingent Christianity is, that it is just one among many, many explanations of the supernatural and why human beings are on the face of the earth that human culture has generated. And why am I drawn to Christianity? Why did I feel moved going to the church in Sinjar and not, say, to the Shiite mosque or to the Yazidi temple, which were equally trashed? And the answer to that is that I've been raised in a Christian tradition. And so perhaps my experience of the transcendence, for that reason, is dyed Christian. And if there is a Christian God, why should people raised in the Christian tradition have that privilege? I mean, what about Muslims or Jews or Hindus or people in, the middle of the Amazon who've never met any Christian? It seems a bit unfair. And this is obviously something that haunted Christians right from the beginning. I mean, what about people who'd existed before the coming of Christ and couldn't be saved? And so that has always been the biggest block for me.
Is it that then is preventing you from going the full C.S. Lewis and converting?
Well, as I say, I essentially have to cut myself off from reason. If I'm inhabiting the dimension of reason, then I don't believe. If I surrender myself to a dimension of myth and poetry and transcendence, then I can believe.
Can I interrupt here? Because my apologetic side of me is going...
Yeah, sorry, Justin.
Here. Because I would... disagree with you. I think it is a false dichotomy, because when you say reason, you kind of mean by that, I think, scientific materialism. But for me, that's the point, isn't it? That it was that Enlightenment sort of project that kind of did a sort of bait and switch there and said, oh, all of this is basically material processes. And it's not that, because, you know, you've read the Church Fathers and Aquinas and everyone else. They were, you know, very reasonable. It's just they lived in a different story. The story of atheist materialism hadn't come to dominate the academy at that point. So I feel like we don't have to surrender our reason. It's just reason has to be baptized in a new worldview. So for me, the whole point is that the myth and imagination and emotion comes together with the quote-unquote objective world of science and facts, but in a very unique moment, which is, for me, Jesus Christ. It's like history, and as Lewis famously said, myth becomes fact. It's this idea that there is this way of joining these two apparently irreconcilable spheres.
I hear you, Justin.
Just do what Tolkien did. That's all it takes. I just think that he saw that. He lived in that ancient world.
Yeah.
He was a perfectly reasonable person. He lived in the 20th century as well. But it's
well,
like,
vaguely. Up to a point.
Can I jump in with another question? This person is part of a leadership team of a church. And Justin, I think this question is probably for you. What do you think I can be doing with my congregation in response to your findings, by which I think they're referring to your book and your thesis?
I think there's a few things. I think, as I said earlier, I think the imagination is really important. It's important to engage that. And my fear is that if we try to too much present Christianity as just a very sort of follow this formula and sign on the dotted line at the bottom, that might work for some people. But for a lot of people, you've got to start somewhere else than at that sort of head place. And for me, it is about connecting with people's heartfelt kind of desires and longings and emotions. And I think, you know, a brilliant example of this was C.S. Lewis, because he was very good at doing the rational apologetics. He did that with, you know, Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain. But what we all really remember C.S. Lewis for is the Narnia stories and the way in which they created a world that people wanted to exist, where, you know, who hasn't knocked on the back of a wardrobe just to check if there is a land of talking beasts and this wonderful wise but not tame lion who rules it and banishes winter and, you know, good overcomes evil. And the point that Lewis made, even in the books, was, well, what if that world really does exist? And there, Lucy, you'll know him by a different name. So I think it's about returning to that imaginative core of Christianity, not sort of just assume, not letting the atheist basically set the terms of the conversation. Basically, we've got to play by the rules of if I can't touch, smell, and feel it, it doesn't actually exist. No, let's say, how about we just change the story? Because I don't think when you actually pick it apart, their version of reality, that story, actually makes sense. I think it's actually got all kinds of problems and holes. And so for me, it's about just let the church be the church and do what it's always done, which is tell people a beautiful story. And then, where necessary, use the tools of reason and whatever to kind of show them that the world they would like to believe really is true. So I'm not against arguments for God or reasons to believe in the resurrection. It's just, I think if you put them front and center, then you're missing a trick. You've got to start with the heart and go from there.
Mm. Justin, what do you think the impact of social media and technology has had on this discussion and the rebirthing of belief in God? And then what's the best reason that you could give for being a Christian?
I'd love to hear Tom's thoughts on the social media thing as well. But I think it's, like anything, it's had both positive and negative effects. So in a way, the new atheism itself was very much birthed because of the coming of age of the internet and lots of people being able to find each other. And like, as they say, you know, a falsehood is halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. And I think that's the internet. It's kind of a breeding ground for all kinds of half-baked facts and theories. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation and lots of movements that develop, including, you know, things like we're about to do a podcast of the surprising rebirth on the Jesus mythicist movement, you know, which has never been taken seriously in any academic circles, but suddenly you'd be forgiven if you just typed that into the internet for thinking it was a genuine kind of scholarly concern. So there's all of that kind of downside that it's kind of made it much easier in a sense to sort of just blindly be a skeptic and that kind of thing. But on the flip side, I think the democratization of social media and the fact that you've now got all kinds of voices that once there were sort of certain traditional media gatekeepers for, so the people like the Petersons, and the fact that you can suddenly have a best-selling podcast like The Rest Is History, and you can have all these things that just didn't exist before the advent of social media, means that there's also far more opportunity for people to kind of go down a YouTube algorithmic rabbit hole, and they might end up with something really bad, but they might also end up with something actually quite interesting and different and that they hadn't been exposed to before. So that it's a very mixed bag, basically. I think the real challenge for the church, with sort of my Christian hat on, is to transcend basically the way that social media has created a kind of tribalistic culture war scenario in so many ways. And for me, the biggest problem probably with social media is that we now effectively live in echo chambers where we only basically hear our own perspectives kind of being fed back to us on a loop. And for me, the church, if it's going to be anything, it has to not play that game. It has to be a place where we genuinely bring people together and hear human to human. It has to be the one remaining place where you could get a whole bunch of people who might be very diverse and find that there's something that unites you that's bigger than you. So for me, I feel like the church has a real duty to not surrender to that direction, if you like, in social media terms. You're on Twitter a lot, though, Tom. So
a lot less. And I have to say that one of the things that really appeals to me about church is that it's an hour or so where you can't check your phone. And I genuinely mean that, you know, it sharpens for me the sense that this is a place apart. Mm. I like that. Mm.
Did you answer the question, Justin, about the best thing about being a Christian?
Was it the best thing about being a Christian? I mean, that's going to be very subjective for each individual. But for me, I think it is hope, honestly, because one of the things I wanted to do in writing the book was inject a bit of hope. I meet a lot of Christians who are a bit, you know, concerned and depressed about the state of the world and the church as well at the moment. And I understand that there's lots of things to be concerned about. But ultimately, if it's true that Jesus rose from the dead, then that's the ultimate expression of hope. And it's the, you know, ultimate story of evil being turned to good and death being turned to life, despair being turned to hope. And I just feel like that's a gift we need to lean into, because it is, for me, the preeminent thing. It's the hope that even in the, what you think is, you know, Richard Dawkins ruling the roost and, you know, everyone's just becoming a secular atheist, it turns out things do turn around, that actually it's often not the end of the story, and that God's got something else in mind. So for me, that's the best thing about being Christian, is that you're always encouraged to be a person of hope.
Mm. We've got time for a couple more.
I think we probably have time for a couple more. I'm trying to sense the atmosphere.
Do people want
in the
a couple
crowd
more?
Would you like a couple more? A couple more?
Yeah, okay.
Let's do it. Go on.
Another kind of top voted one, which you may have answered throughout the course of the evening, which, of course, do let us know. But which public figure has moved the needle for the surprising rebirth the most, and why would you say that is?
So, as I said earlier, I think Peterson, yep. Tom Holland has made a remarkable. I mean, I'd be interested in Tom, actually. Who? Yeah. Because.
Oh, Justin Bryan.
Do you
Bryan.
Think... No, that doesn't... No. What? I mean, I've got my perspective on all this, Tom, but I'd be interested in whether you think that this is happening. Basically, I mean, when you look out at your contemporaries, the people you're talking to, do you feel like there's a different kind of openness or conversation going on among some of them?
Well, my experience is slewed by the fact that I've authored... You know, I've written a book which argues that Christianity is incredibly important. And so I find myself talking to lots of people who do think that Christianity is incredibly important. And so my sense of that is obviously influenced by that. One of the things that strikes me is that the focus has been on people who are outside Christianity that you're talking about. Mm. And you haven't talked about any Christian figures. Mm. And I kind of looking back and thinking of, you know, titanic figures in the 20th century, Martin Luther King or Tolkien or C.S. Lewis, you've mentioned. I mean, figures who had real cultural cut through, or John Paul II. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were figures who everyone knew. They were globally famous. Are there any Christian figures of comparable status now who everyone's heard of? I guess the Pope, but I mean, chiefly it just seems to be Catholics moaning about it, as far as I can tell.
I get what you're saying. I think in that sense, that's partly, it is the de-Christianization, the secularization of the West that means that those voices that were at the front of the civil rights movement and that were these sort of characters, I think they've kind of have been to some extent replaced by secular voices or secular versions almost of that. I still, what I find, I suppose, encouraging though, is that after a lot of headlines about the secularization of the West, that you still find really surprising examples of people suddenly becoming Christian. And so one person that I've had the opportunity to interview a couple of times is Paul Kingsnorth. Now, I'm not saying he's at the same level of Pope John Paul II or anything like that, but he's just a fascinating example of someone who was not a candidate for Christianity, and yet through a strange series of occurrences and a sense that he was being drawn to something, you know, as a celebrated author and poet, he suddenly finds himself believing in the Christian story. And again, having an outside influence, I think, on a lot of his readership and his following, where I just wonder if it's not necessarily that there's these major figures who are kind of drawing people as Christians, but there are lots of interesting examples of people who have a platform and suddenly start talking about God in a new way. And it's almost like, that's why I keep going back to you being sort of our best kept secret as an evangelist, Tom, because it's almost like...
Well, I mean, Justin, if I'm the best evangelist, then the church really is in
trouble. But I'm being serious, because the problem is, a Billy Graham today, the reason he was so successful in, you know, these mass campaigns and evangelism was because it was still a fundamentally Christian culture he was speaking to. He just had to kind of remind people and paint the gospel in a kind of a new way for people. And suddenly that cultural memory that was very strong kicked in the 50s and 60s. Now, 70 plus years on from that, that's all changed. And I think that's why you do need voices like yours, Tom, and the others who are kind of not obviously in the Christian church. That's the voices that people listen to, because they feel like they're not just being sold a package, because you're saying something from outside the church.
I mean, just to be a real downer, I mean, I think of Martin Luther King, who certainly in the English-speaking world, I think is by far the most influential Christian figure of the past, you know, whatever, century. And the civil rights movement was a deeply Christian movement. It was suffused with the language of the Bible, whether it was, Jesus as an extremist for love, or the language of Exodus moving from slavery into the promised land. It absolutely suffused it. And the power of that is still absolutely manifest, particularly in America, for obvious reasons. But it's ceased to be Christian. And it's often quite opposed to Christianity. You know, Christianity in certainly the kind of the progressive movements in the United States, whether it's gay rights or trans rights or feminism or whatever, civil rights still, they are often framing Christianity as the enemy. It's kind of, you know, red-faced evangelicals kind of jabbing their fingers and saying that, you know, God hates fags and all that kind of thing. And I still think that it's an intra-Christian civil war, but one side, I think, has forgotten that it's Christian. And that does seem to me a diminishment of the scope for Christianity to enthuse people, because I can't think of anyone who is using biblical language in the public sphere in the way that Martin Luther King did. I mean, maybe the last person really to do that was Angela Merkel, when she let in all the refugees, clearly inspired by the story of the Good Samaritan. But it's really telling that she didn't go public with that. Mm. She didn't feel she could say that, whereas I think, you know, maybe three or four generations before she would have done.
I just to add a comment to that, I do think you're right. What you've got today is a lot of people still essentially swimming in Christian waters, but who've essentially forgotten that that was the impetus for their social justice movement. I just wonder, though, whether it will get to a point where a kind of a fatigue sets in, because I don't think you can sustain that
in a purely secular
sort of framework. And I think the reason why Martin Luther King was so successful is because ultimately it was rooted in a Christian ethic, in a hope that goes beyond just, you know, a Marxist, you know, sort of version of Christianity or whatever it is. And I just feel like we're reaching a point in our culture where I think people will burn out. There'll be a burnout in terms of trying to save ourselves through...
Going very left field, I'm aware that we're overrunning it. People probably won't want to branch off on this. But another thing that just strikes me is that the story of Exodus was so important to Martin Luther King. I think Exodus is possibly been the most transformative narrative ever told. Mm. It's had a huge influence, not just on Christians, whether it's, you know, the Pilgrim Fathers or whatever, but on the emergence of Islam. I mean, Islam is unthinkable without Exodus. Obviously, it's the foundational story for Jews as well. But I think in the Christian church at the moment, I sense a nervousness specifically about the Old Testament. And particularly in the context of what's happening in Gaza at the moment, there's a kind of nervousness about promised lands and people from exile coming and claiming it and all this. And I think that is another part of what is making people nervous about certainly the Bible and the Old Testament. And you can sense it, I think, in Christians.
On which note, before...
on that bombshell.
Before fatigue sets in here at Westminster Chapel, I mean, one of the interesting things is that we talked about these figures, and I suppose what's so fascinating is they often emerged out of crisis, whether it's political, economic, social, cultural crisis. And I guess there's a question that hangs in the air for us tonight as to whether we're in a moment of crisis and whether out of that figures will rise that speak into it. I guess the challenge also is the extent to which, or the question is the extent to which this remains a discussion and something that is reserved for the sort of the middle classes, even the intelligentsia. How does this work out for the person in Doncaster, the average person in Wigan? One final thought on that before we close, Justin.
I think that obviously the Christian story, if it's true, is for everyone. And while this may be a particularly interesting manifestation, that's where we're talking about sort of some of these interesting secular intellectuals and so on, who I think are moving the needle, I think it will ultimately be something that is felt in its own way in all different spheres. So for me, if there is a rebirth of belief in God, it's certainly not just for the middle classes. It's going to be something that works its way out. I'm not a good prophet. I don't know what that will be. Again, that's the Christian hope in me speaking, that actually the common thread, whether you're sitting here in Westminster Chapel or anywhere else, whatever your situation is that you have to live in a story that makes sense of your life. And I just think we're reaching if there is a crisis point, it's that people are kind of running out of steam in the stories they're telling, whether they think of themselves as middle class, working class, whatever demographic they come from. There's some kind of a story that shapes their life. And I think the stories that are currently most prevalent in our culture are just not doing the job for people. So that's why I think ultimately there is a space for the Christian story to speak again quite powerfully to people. It might get worse before it gets better. And I think crisis is an interesting moment. I think you're right. That story has tended to come out in crisis moments. And so I don't know if that does happen, I don't know what sort of catalyst will look like, but it's going to be something where the church is again given an opportunity to kind of present a different way of living in the world, a new And that's the big challenge, I think, for me as a Christian and for anyone who calls himself a Christian, is how do we genuinely present this story afresh to people who have forgotten it but are still basically living on the embers of it in their life, and I think ultimately looking for something like that.
Well, Justin and Tom, thank you so much. This has been fun, hasn't it, Grace?
It's been brilliant.
I mean, it's been so interesting and stretching and challenging and inspiring, but I think I can speak for everyone in the room in saying that we're so grateful to you both for the thought that you've put into some of these questions and for your openness here this evening. We've really appreciated that. Thank you for your work. We have an opportunity in a little while to purchase that. And therefore, if you would like to purchase Tom's book, Dominion, we've got available tonight. Very, very attractive discounts on this evening. It's Mothering Sunday, this coming Sunday. I mean, I can't think of anything better than a copy of, well, Tom and one of Justin's books. So we've got a few different books from Justin, but obviously particularly The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. It's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you to you in the audience. We have been inundated with questions. It's just impossible to work through them. But I'm sure if you queue up and buy a book, you could put your question as you do so, and maybe in the early hours of tomorrow morning we can close up. But from Grace and from me, thank you and goodbye. Would you please show your appreciation for Justin Brierley and Tom Holland?
Thank you for listening to today's special edition of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And thanks to our friends at LICC for hosting the event. And huge thanks, of course, to Tom Holland for being a brilliant conversation partner. Feel free to look me up on social media and share what you think of today's show. And do share this episode on your own timeline if you want other people to discover the show. Rating and reviewing the podcast also helps other people to find it. And just to remind you, the book Tom and I were discussing is The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. You can read the first chapter for free when you join my newsletter at justinbrierley.com, where you can also order the book or get a signed copy. I'm really glad to announce as well that this podcast was recently among the recipients of the Zenger Prize, awarded to 10 journalists each year for, I quote, street-level, biblically objective, skillful journalistic storytelling. The specific episode nominated was episode 10, History Maker, Why Tom Holland Changed His Mind About Jesus. The judges said they awarded the prize for rugged reporting about atheists and atheists become Christians that shows how hearts and minds are restless until they find their rest in God, and for offering listeners complex theological truths in understandable ways. Well, thank you so much to the Zenger Prize. I was really thrilled to hear that we'd won this prize for a competition which, in all honesty, I hadn't even heard of or had entered. But that's how the Zenger Prize do it. And special mention as well to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Simmons, for whom this prize is also shared. So great to have that encouragement only a few months into this new podcast. What I also find incredibly encouraging is when people get on board to support the show financially. It makes such a difference to us being able to produce quality content that reaches the culture. Supporting also gets you early access to new episodes of the podcast and bonus content. Gold supporters also get those signed copies of my book and the chance for a monthly catch-up too. So if you'd like to get on board and support, the links are with today's show. Coming up next time, we begin a new act of our series. You know, is there any kind of evidence in the universe that could make... I mean, if the stars lined up to spell, Peter, please believe in me, it's about time.
I put it down to madness.
Sounds like, Peter, that there's no evidence that would persuade you away from atheism.
Well, to be honest, I think that's probably the case.
We'll be exploring the surprising rebirth of an alternative story about science. But you don't need to wait. As I said, you can get access to our next episode right now when you become a silver or gold supporter. Today's show was a production of Think Faith in partnership with Genexis and with support from the Jerusalem Trust. Editing assistance on this occasion from Peter Byram. You can find out more and how to support my efforts to bring thinking faith to the secular and Christian world at justinbrierley.com. The links are with today's show. For now, thanks for listening. See you next time.